Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces. My name is Coleman, and I will be your host today. And we're going to have Bob Burnett joining us with Barefoot Mining, and I'm really looking forward to this one. I've been looking forward to it for the last couple of weeks. I have a lot of questions for Bob, get his insight on the mining side of things, where he sees it's going to be going, some implications with the price of Bitcoin right now. I know he made a post a couple months ago about Dante's levels, different levels of hell for the miners. So I want to get his thoughts on that with this price action chopping around 60,000. But before we start kicking into everything and introducing Bob, I want to make sure everybody understands the purpose of why we do this show every day, Monday through Friday. And that's to make sure that we're defending the rights and the values that our founding fathers fought so hard for. Show people what Bitcoin can do for our communities. As you know, we have boots on the ground right now in North Carolina with Operation Gabriel. I want to give a huge shout out to everybody who's helped us with this effort, to everyone who's donated sats, to everyone who's donated fiat, and everyone who's just tweeted or retweeted that link up at the top. I want to give you a huge thank you. And that's what makes this show possible. To date, we've raised over $105,000. And so this money's going to making sure that we can get supplies that everybody needs, cold weather clothing, making sure that we can get fuel, heaters. And so we'll give you a quick update before we jump into things with Bob. But again, that's the whole purpose of Bitcoin Veterans, showing that we can do everything decentralized. We don't need big government to be involved. And just with our local communities and our outreach, we can make a giant impact on everything. So if you're new to the show, first time listening to us, or you've just been a long time listener and you've never tried to reach out, please send us a message. We're happy to answer any questions you have, happy to point you in the right direction. And most of all, we just love talking with all of you. So please feel free to reach out to us. So Jordan, I know that I think you're heading up to North Carolina today. Do you want to give a quick brief or update of everything going on with Operation Gabriel?
I'm not heading up until next week, early next week, but guys are still on the ground getting after it. There's just as far as on the ground, it's still like a very dynamic situation. I think all like the immediate life-saving stuff is over. It's shifting more now to like sustainment, and there's still people without power and that still are cut off and still need, you know, food and supplies delivered. And as the weather gets colder, we're working to get them cold weather gear and whatnot. So that's kind of like the on the ground, what's happening. But then, you know, we're kind of shifting to like a focusing on longer term, sustainment. So like, there's a big need for hay. This is something like a lot of people probably aren't thinking about, but when all this water came in, it destroyed a lot or most of the stockpiles that they had of hay. And so if they start losing their livestock, you start losing all the ability to farm in that area, and that entire area becomes less self-sufficient. So we're working on getting hay out to them, and I've been working like the last 24 hours developing a local network, and I have multiple sources that are like, hey, yeah, we have hay that's available. We can give it to you for free. We just have to figure out how to get it there. So actively developing that network of using my community as much as possible to be self-sufficient in running this operation to get hay out there. There's that going on, and then supply runs. We've kind of been ratlining supplies into the area, which is just like onesies and twosies of people that are going to the area that can help. So building out that network for longer sustainment of somebody that like, hey, I can do a run every Tuesday, and I got a guy over here that can do a run every Thursday or whatever, and getting a longer term sustainment going to that area. So obviously, like we've said over and over, we really appreciate everybody's support and donations. Luckily, it seems like Milton didn't affect Florida nearly as much, or at least Florida's able to prepare and respond to that much better. This is just a very different situation down there. So I would just ask people to not take your eye off the ball. Don't get distracted by the next thing. The people in North Carolina are still going to need our help for quite a while. And we've got long-term plans to help with that. We just ask that people continue to help, support, chip in, pray, whatever you can do to help. It's going to be a long road to recovery.
Yeah, it's going to be a really long road. And so, again, I want to thank everybody who's donated and everyone who's retweeted that link at the top. It does mean a lot. And to whoever that anonymous person was that donated a whole Bitcoin to us, it really goes a long way. And again, when we're out here, the biggest thing is there's no power and no communication. So we're trying to set up those links, those networks. We're using our Meshtastic devices, and we've made contact and we're partnering with local assets in the area. So the Tennessee National Guard is partnered with us, or we're utilizing, not really partnered, but we're utilizing them to move equipment, supplies, and make drops for us. But we also gave them our Meshtastic devices. So essentially we have a low orbit Starlinks at our disposal that we're able to use and make these communications possible. So it's really, really interesting. If you click at that top link that's in the Nest and just follow the thread, we're giving daily updates of everything that's going on. So again, I really appreciate everything. And I just want to make sure that you all know how grateful we are for everything you're doing. But without any further ado, I definitely want to introduce our guest for today, Bob Burnett with Barefoot Mining. How are you doing, sir?
Good morning. I am well. First of all, thank you for what you're doing there. Up in the Carolinas, I am actually coming to you from Naples, Florida today, and we just dodged a major bullet, but the people just north of us are hurting badly. This devastation is amazing. We got hit 2 years ago with Hurricane Ian, and I had 4 feet of water through the bottom of my house during that storm. So I'm very sympathetic to what the people up there are going through, both, you know, the Tampa area as well as further north from the earlier hurricane. If you've never been through something like that, it's really difficult to imagine. Even today, honestly, although my home, my home, which is relatively close to the ocean, we got within about 2 feet of the water breaching our house again last night from the storm surge. So we have no power. We have no cell service. I'm actually coming to you from a Walgreens parking lot about 20 miles from my house, which was the first place I could get cell service. But I wanted to join you guys today. So this is important to me. So anyway, I am doing well, and I appreciate you guys having me on today.
Well, thank you, and I love that. No excuses, found a way to get on the show. So I really appreciate that, Bob. It means a lot to us. So I don't know where exactly you would like to start with everything, with maybe an update with the mining sector. I think it was back in July you made that Twitter thread or tweet.
Yeah.
What about Dante's miner hell levels? Do you want to kind of go in? Because the price has been sitting essentially at about 55 to 60 for the last 70 days.
Yeah, we've spent an extended period of time in hell. And we have kind of the perfect storm that's been hitting the mining sector, where fees are making.
Bob, you're starting to go into the matrix a little bit there. Can you hear me? We can't hear you right now, Bob. You're going in and out. No, we still can't hear you. I'm just going to give you a couple minutes to try and see if we can get back in connection, Bob. You're going in and out really bad. So I'm not sure if you changed spots.
Hey, Coleman, while we wait for Bob to get back on, now might be a good opportunity to talk about some of the recruitment effort that we're trying to do to get volunteers up to help with Operation Gabriel. And I think Gabe Lord, he looks like he's a listener to me, but maybe he's up here if he wants to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm up here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Yeah, so we just posted up in the Nest a link to it's just a simple, straightforward Google form to collect some information. There will be a need for volunteers for quite some time. So those that have been following this and wanting to get involved and waiting for that opportunity, now it is here. So we're going to need hands. You know, the devastation is extensive. It's like Jordan said, there are people there that are not going to have electricity for quite some time. And the need will persist, even though the news coverage will decrease for the people there. It doesn't need to be on the news for it to be very real for the need to exist for them. And so hop on there if you're serious about it. We do encourage you to, you know, be self-aware enough to recognize your ability to truly be an asset. Be prepared to defend yourself, bring means to provide self-defense. Not that it's a war zone by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a somewhat volatile situation as post-disaster areas tend to be. So we do ask that, be prepared to get yourself there and back. We're not going to be reimbursing travel expenses, things like that. It's just not how it's going to work. So be able to get yourself there, be ready to work, and we will find work for you to do. And it take 5 minutes, fill out the form, and let us know. And if you have any questions, again, just shoot us a DM. It's up in the Nest. It's posted on our pinned tweet on X. And yeah, we do need hands up there. There's a lot of work to be done. So if you're looking for something to get involved in, bring it on. We got something for you.
Yeah, and it's not going to be just a short-term thing. I think Shane was mentioning they expect about 3 to 6 months before they get any sort of power back to a lot of these remote communities. And we're going into the winter months. It's going to get a lot colder. So we can use any help if you're able to. Again, know your limits, know your capabilities. And if you don't think that you're going to be able to help boots on the ground, you can help us in other ways by, you know, helping us with find assets, helping us retweet that link in the top, and just getting the message spread. That'll be the best thing to do. Bob, I see you're back up. Your better connection now. If you're talking, I can't hear you. Can anyone else hear Bob?
I cannot.
All right, Bob, we still can't hear you. Maybe if we try again, if not, we might have to schedule this for a different day when
you're able to. Hey, Bob, try the CVS across the street. That might be better than the Walgreens.
Okay, so we'll still talk about Operation Gabriel. There's still a lot going on with that. And again, so we're trying to coordinate different things with Hurricane Milton because we expected that to be a lot worse. And so we do have situations going on, but as of right now, I think the effect of the storm was less severe than everyone anticipated. But we still have people ready to go out and help where needed with that. So the money that's coming in, the money that's coming in for Operation Gabriel isn't limited to only the North Carolinas and the Appalachians arena. Area, we will use those funds to help out wherever is necessary. And so it's just really important that everybody knows that. And again, the funds and the cool thing about us being able to go out here and do this is that we're showing people the power of what Bitcoin can do. When Shane's out there, he's talking about decentralized communication and how to go about things and just spreading our message that we talk about so much. So it's really, really it's a really good cost that we're doing up there. Gabe or Jordan, do you have anything else you want to add that I might have missed for Operation Gabe?
I'm just going to say that, of course, we're documenting everything that's taking place, all the actions that we're taking. I'm not sure how aware everybody is, but this was a spontaneous reaction to an immediate need that was taken. And it's like I've said before, it just so happens that you have a group of people that are very proficient and competent that spring into action and are making things happen, but also at the same time have the presence of mind to document what's happening, to record what we're doing, to break it down and to learn lessons that are there in front of us that we can not only share with other people, because obviously, we all have an open source mentality when it comes to so many things that we do, but also prepare us to conduct other types of operations in the future like this. Just the lessons that we're learning from the Meshtastic intervention, they're already being shared with other groups throughout different avenues and channels on social media to help them to be prepared. We're demonstrating how it's impacting the situation on the ground up in North Carolina and showing other people, look, this is something that we've done in response. But imagine what you do if you said something like this beforehand. And so we're actually helping other people to prepare for things of this nature. And it's turned into a huge learning experience, while at the same time proving beneficial to the people on the ground up there in NC. So it's going to continue to be a long road, and we're learning things every day as we go. And we're learning how to better serve the people that are up there, in addition to, like I said, preparing other people for the eventuality that things happen. Because, as we all know, things do happen. And if we pay attention right now, it's just like a 1-2 punch that has just been another 1-2 punch after another. And I think it's a healthy reminder of the importance of taking actions to stay ready, to be prepared, to know that, it's more than just going through your normal daily operations and anticipating some sense of predictability in your life. Stuff's going to pop up. I don't even know what's going on up in Wyoming, but apparently things are burning down all over the place up there. And so we have to ask ourselves, I know there's a lot of wide open country, but people do live up there. And so these situations are going to arise. They're going to happen. We're going to learn from it. And there are people here that do want to serve and will step into the gap and will serve when the call arises. So, yeah, a lot of lessons being learned here. And also we would invite anybody who's involved in any recovery efforts here, things that they're learning that they want to share with us. Let's open source all of the lessons that we're learning from this entire experience and make it so everybody is in a better state of preparedness, and also better equipped to react when things happen. Cause we're about Bitcoin, right? I mean, we're here, we're all talking, we've all been connected. We've all got that common theme in place, which is Bitcoin, but it's more than just about Bitcoin itself. It's about people. It's about each other. It's about how we can improve one another's lives. It's about how we can serve one another. And I believe that was, regardless of who you think HBO tells you Satoshi Nakamoto is, I believe that he created this for people, obviously. It's not just to have a cool new technology that can be FU money just for the sake of being FU money. It really is about making humanity better. It really is about us connecting with one another and serving one another. And when the need arises, being there for one another and being equipped and being self-sovereign enough and being self-sufficient enough to be able to respond in ways that are going to help one another when the call goes out.
Thank you, Gabe. Yeah, just make sure that you're prepared and try and plan for different scenarios. You're not going to be 100% prepared. You're not going to be 100% prepared for everything. But as long as you have a game plan and you have resources, you can pretty much get yourself out of anything. Bob, we got you backed up here. Let's try a third time's a charm.
Okay, let's give it a rip. Hopefully this
all right, perfect. Okay. Yeah, we can hear you perfect now.
All right. Well, I'm... got like one arm hanging out my window and, a leg out the other window, trying to like the old days when we had a tuna TV antenna. So I think you had asked a question about the miner's hell and kind of what was going on there. So if I pick that up, there's always three vectors or three factors that determine, you know, where miner profitability sits. Price is certainly a major one. Global hash rate's the second, and the third is fees. So let's talk about fees for a minute. Fees are the one I think people aren't talking about from the perspective of the miner in the short term. They have dropped to amazingly low levels. So the historical average, so if you go back over the last 15 years, the historical average of fees for block is about 0.4. So about 0.4 Bitcoin per block. And while there's been variance in that over that time period, it's actually been relatively consistent, amazingly. You know, we saw a blip last year, and then again in the early part of this year in the halving, but now we're just down at this really, really low level. So we're more like a tenth, like 0.1 to 0.15 Bitcoin have been like typical block levels. So we're losing like two tenths right there on average. And that really stings. Price is the most obvious indicator, and it's been brutal. So frankly, I think most people in the mining industry, if you're smart, you've planned for this, and you knew that this was a possibility, but it really tests us. And I think if you look at the industry as a whole, you'll see pretty much everybody's experiencing a great degree of pain anytime we're in this low 60s and below. And that was the basis of the tweet from several weeks ago that you're referring to. And then there's global hash rate. And I would say global hash rate is unnaturally high right now. That this is kind of a deeper subject and a bit of a rabbit hole, but I think we're in a somewhat unhealthy position in the industry. And a lot of it is impacted by the bigger miners. And if you think of the way the bigger miners work, and I'm talking about primarily the public guys, although there's a few like really, really large ones. In essence, what they do is, you know, they build out in big increments. So they're looking at a 50 megawatt site, 100 megawatt site, a couple hundred megawatt site. They have really long lead times in which to develop that. So, you know, those companies would have been looking, you know, well before the halving and making capital expansion plans. And they're, of course, guessing what they're going to do. Like, where is the market going to be? How profitable are they going to be? And there's a lot of guesswork involved. And so when they come up with those big operations, it's unknown whether they're coming into a bull market or a bear market or where's the fee market. They don't really know. And so additionally, they're incented to make these bets on these bigger operations because the market rewards them for doing so. And there's I actually believe it's an infection of the fiat system into the Bitcoin system, where almost a Cantillon effect type thing, where it's easy for public miners especially to either create convertible debt or issue new share issuance. And if they take that money and then they expand operations, what they've learned, kind of the Pavlovian response of this, is they do that. They dilute shares or they take on the debt. But then as soon as they announce they're expanding, they get rewarded. And so the stock price goes up. It's kind of, this thing has happened. So I think from the perspective of their business, I understand why they do it, but it's kind of this easy lose money that comes into play. And I think my interpretation, I'm not inside those rooms, but my interpretation is they somewhat feel like they're following Saylor and the MicroStrategy formula for this hash rate expansion. And I contrast that to the, for instance, the way we work. We do things as a small to medium-sized commercial miner. We do things in very small bites in short windows. So like I'm working on a project right now. My next site will be a 2-megawatt site. And from the point of raising the money to the point of being up is probably going to be like 8 weeks. So in other words, as we deploy capital, we deploy it into a market with kind of known business conditions. Now, of course, we don't know what's going to happen 1 or 2 or 4 years down the road, but if things are unfavorable in the short term, we don't expand. If they are favorable in the short term, we do expand. And favorable doesn't just mean the factors in miners' hell, but it also means what's the cost of energy we're getting, what's the price of the equipment that we're buying. You know, a lot of those factors come into play as well. So the moral of all that is I think we've reached a pretty unhealthy spot. Now, a big spike in the Bitcoin price makes all that seem a lot better pretty quickly. But on the other hand, if instead of a price increase and bringing us back to 75 or testing a new all-time high, we go test 45, there's going to be massive carnage.
So how much longer do you think some of these miners that are smaller can hold on at these prices and a hash rate of what it's at? If you had to guess.
Well, I think we're going to start reaching people's threshold here like soon, like in the next month or two. Because that's the other thing is, see, if you look at, I'm not here just to bash public miners, but if you look at a public miner, because of what they do, for the most part, if you go look at the financials over the last couple years of any public miner, it's a bloodbath. They're very operationally inefficient. They've lost a lot of money. A lot of them are pivoting toward high-performance computing and AI, which I think is a good move for them. If I was in that seat, I would do the same thing. But they've been a bloodbath. Private miners like me, we have to be profitable and cash flow positive because we don't have a big, massive treasury that we can sit on. We don't have the same ability to go raise money quickly in capital markets, even when we're losing money. Right. So I would say a lot of the private miners are, like I said, they're feeling a lot of pain. And if this extends through the end of the year, I think there will be a lot of carnage. And what's terrible about that is these are companies that maybe at these thresholds are just barely unprofitable, but they just don't have any, they just don't have any reserves. So what you kind of could, I'm not saying this will happen, but it's my concern, is at the end of the thing, what you could, at the end of this whole thing, is what you could end up with is the more inefficient miners surviving and the less efficient ones dying. Maybe a little bit like what Amazon did to local retail. Like maybe there's a little bit of an analogy there. So I'm not predicting that. I don't want to scare people, but that's what this worries me. Like, I think it could create an unhealthy situation for the industry.
Well, how important would it be for these smaller miners to try and incorporate AI and using those facilities to offset their costs? Do you think that's going to be the new business model moving forward, or?
No, because for the most part, well, there's a couple things. One is, building AI facilities and building Bitcoin facilities are radically different. The way that you construct the data center. Smaller guy, that's one issue. The second issue is we don't have enough power typically to be interesting to these sites. And third, if you're mining in an off-grid situation, where maybe your uptime is 95% or 92%, that's not good enough. You can't, it just doesn't work. So I don't think that pivot is available to the small guys.
Okay. So you're talking about how some of these bigger ones are going to eventually take over the smaller miners just because they can't afford at these prices. There was a post I saw a couple. Go ahead.
I that's not necessarily true, but I'm sorry to cut you off. Here's the thing though. So going forward, like I mentioned, I have a new site coming up. It's about 2 megawatts. So I'll share this, you know, with the group. My cost of energy at that site is less than 2 cents per kilowatt. Now, I can do, it's an off-grid situation, fairly unique one. I can't tell you all the details of it, but like I can, that kind of opportunity exists, but only in smaller chunks. Okay, and there's a lot of off-grid stuff, whether that's hydro, natural gas. On a different project, I'll say I'm in the process of acquiring natural gas wells, where I'm just buying the well itself, small stranded gas wells myself, and we're buying those. And we can achieve operational efficiency that the big guys can't get. So they can't compete with those price thresholds. But smaller miners that are grid-based, smaller miners, I'm somewhat fortunate in that even though as a smaller miner, I probably have a little better access to capital than most of the small miners out there. So that gives me the opportunity to develop some of these sites. But it's still possible. But, you know, and I think it's important for the infrastructure that that happen. It's very important that the big miners not take over too much of the infrastructure. It's a whole nother rabbit hole, but anybody that's out there, I did an article in Bitcoin Magazine about, I guess, coming up on 3 years ago called Satoshi's Heel, which talks about the mathematics behind what happens if it's all big miners and it's not pretty. Like we need at least 30% of the infrastructure to remain with the small, medium-sized miners and the plebs that kind of take a completely different approach to mining than the big guys.
What's that percentage at right now? Do you know?
I'd still say we're over half.
There's 50% is small miners?
Yeah, maybe even a little more. Small slash private. Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't think it was that much. I figured the big guys had a pretty decisive control over everything.
No. And I think there's a, you know, I think there's this misnomer that happens in the industry. And I think it happens naturally because the big guys, of course, are the ones that are in the news. Right. They're the sponsors at the big conferences. Their executives are on the podcasts. They're issuing the press releases and the small guys are out kind of, you know, I may be a little more vocal and out than most of the small guys, but a lot of them want to be anonymous. A lot of them, you don't know they're happening and they want it that way. I completely respect that.
Okay.
But the trend is dangerous, right? So, you know, one of the things I speak a lot about is building Bitcoin to be money for the next 1,000 years. And so we're constantly going to be faced, I'm as Bitcoin maxi as a Bitcoin maxi can be. I believe Bitcoin is divinely inspired, but I don't believe it's perfect, meaning that it's infallible, that it requires constant attention and constant care. And there are several different ways we could misstep it, abuse it. And then we're also going to constantly have attack vectors. And so we can't ever be complacent that these these things are going to constantly happen. I think this is just another one that we're facing. We're not in a spot right now where we're in danger, but we're on a vector toward one that could become dangerous.
How much weight do you contribute to the mining pools themselves? Because I believe it was Bitcoin Magazine last month put out an article where 55% of the mining pools are in China and 40% are in America. Did you happen to see that?
I did not, but another part of my history, something you have to be aware of, is I am on the board of directors of Ocean, and I'm also an investor in the Ocean. And Barefoot was the first company to commit hash rate to that pool. And the reason for that, number one reason for that, is that I saw this. Like when I started talking with the Ocean team about what they were trying to accomplish back in the summer of 2023, I jumped on immediately because I was aware of this. I don't have that article, but basically the top six pools control over 90% of the hash rate. Four of them are in China, two are in the U.S. It's Luxor and Foundry in the U.S., and then four Chinese pools, F2 Pool, Poolin, I'm drawing a blank on Ant Pool. I forgot the fourth one at the moment. But to make matters worse, the template creation, which I don't want to go into too deep of a rabbit hole, but template creation is basically the decision process by which what transactions go into a block is made. So that's template creation. And lack of diversity in template creation is a huge issue because we're at a point where we really only have four or five major points where those decisions are being made. Most of them are being, I have to be careful with my words here. Most of them are being influenced or controlled by Bitmain. So Bitmain, even though they're different pools, you can see that the pools are creating the same templates and the output of the Coinbase. So this is where the subsidy and the fees, which is the reward, even though they're different pools, they go to the same output. So they really aren't independent. That's the moral of the story. So what we try to do with Ocean, and we just announced this about 10 days ago, is the creation of something called Datum. And Datum is a method where each miner within Ocean now can create their own template. So within one pool, I can create my template and make my transaction selections. And Coleman, if you were another miner, you would make your own transaction selections. But if you win, you share the appropriate amount of money with me. If I win, I share the appropriate amount of money with you. This is important because what's happened is, if you think about why does a pool exist, a pool exists to stabilize miner revenue and take people that would otherwise have to wait years to win a block reward, given the amount of hash rate they have, an opportunity to still participate in the network. That's the real function of a pool. But what's happened is, over the course of the last, especially 7 or 8 years, the pool has taken on a massive amount of power. In fact, to the degree that people using other pools, like for instance, if you connect your miner to Foundry, I'll say something a little radical here. You are actually not a miner. You are a hasher. I call them mercenaries. You're a mercenary hasher. You are simply renting your hash rate to that pool. And by that, on a technical basis, you don't even know if the work that they are giving you is for Bitcoin. Well, probably is. I'm not accusing anybody of that. But there's no way to know whether or not what they're giving you is Bitcoin or not. you're being compensated based on the way that the Bitcoin network is performing, but it's more like an index, like if in the stock market, like, you know, you're not buying the stocks, you don't own the stocks, you have an index tied to the market. So the only way to really be a miner is to create your own block template. Because like, for instance, we are doing this now at Barefoot. We run a node and we create the template and then we share the profits through Ocean versus the way the other pools work, where if I connect to one of those, I get paid, but I really don't know what work I did for that.
What other work are you referencing to outside of, like you said, if Foundry, if I was to point my hash towards them, you don't know if you're getting Bitcoin. What did you mean by that?
Well, you're going to get paid in Bitcoin, but you don't know what they're using that machine for. They could be sending you Bitcoin Cash work and not Bitcoin, Bitcoin SV. They could. Or this is something I'm just in the process of announcing. I have a new project that I am rolling out kind of as we speak. It's in beta, and it's I've developed a technique to create proof of work based random numbers. So I have a tiny bit of my hash right now that does work that's completely unrelated to Bitcoin that uses S19s, for instance. And so what we can do is we can generate random numbers. Anybody interested, you can go to a website called chaosengine.com, chaosengine.com. And for instance, you can ask us to generate a random number for you, or flip a coin, or roll dice, or shuffle a deck of cards, or things like that. And behind the scenes, all of the number generation and randomness is being generated by an S19.
I've heard you speak of this before. Can you go into a little bit more depth as to why that's so important to have guaranteed randomness?
Yeah. So it's really impossible to ever authenticate randomness. So first of all, random numbers are very, very important in the world. They are, you know, you interface with it every day. Your two-factor authentication, you play online poker, you in financial sector and you run a Monte Carlo analysis. If there's a military draft, and in the old days, I remember sitting in front of the TV when I was a little boy, hoping that the birth date of my uncles didn't come up in the military draft. Like, all those things are places where randomness is important, but there's really no way in the real world to authenticate the randomness. If you bore down into it, what you'll find is that the randomness can be manipulated, or there can be issues with the instrumentation that generates it. So at the end of the day, there's always an element of trust required. So when I looked at that problem, I was trying to solve two problems. Full disclosure, actually, the first problem I wanted to solve was there's a belief, a very pervasive belief within the Bitcoin community, that products like an S19 or an M30 or all these different Bitcoin mining rigs are single purpose units. And often people will call them ASICs. And I objected. So I'm an engineer. I'm probably overly sensitive about this, but for me, specificity in language is like super important. Like, I believe that as part of a social construct, if we lose the definition of words, we lose control of a language, then we lose the very fabric of whatever society or organization that we're working on. And if you doubt that, just go read 1984 again. But what I saw was, I saw as an industry, us calling a machine like an S19 and ASIC. It still happens very common in our industry. What you're doing is, ASIC stands for Application Specific Integrated Circuit. So first, it's wrong to call a machine that. The machine is not the chip. The machine contains a chip or a series of chips. But second, when you call the machine something that starts with application specific, what you are doing is you are giving regulatory and tax authorities and bureaucrats you're handing to them a silver platter, a very easy way to regulate our entire industry. If I can show the world that that machine is capable of doing other things completely unrelated to Bitcoin, we cut that off at the knees. Okay. So a couple years ago, I became worried about this, about the industry using the word ASIC. And I became very worried about regulators trying to just look at a given machine and say, okay, we're going to tax you differently. And we saw in the spring of 2023, the Biden administration attempt to do that very thing. And that, in their proposed 2024 budget in the spring of 2023, they proposed a 30% tax on Bitcoin mining. And the only way for them to implement it was by having people say, if you're using a specific machine, then we're going to tax that electricity consumption. And there have been other places, Kazakhstan, Norway, et cetera, where similar legislation has come up. So the point that I could say, hey, I have another legitimate application for this same type of equipment. I cut that off. And what I realized was that the double shot 256 algorithm that we run at the core of those machines provides a phenomenal mechanism for random number generation. And if I do the same thing Satoshi did and combine it with proof of work and a difficulty level, I can create auditable and verifiable random numbers. So we're basically launching this service right now, where if somebody wants to buy numbers from us, they can come to us and we can provide an API and we can stream millions of auditable and verifiable random numbers. We are building an online casino that will be the fairest casino the world's ever seen, where if you're playing a hand of blackjack and you lose to the dealer because the dealer, I don't know, hit a 7-card string and ended up with a 21 and beat you, you can click a button and audit it, and you can see the actual blockchain and the verification of those numbers. And there's a billion other applications that we're going to be rolling out. So now when somebody comes in to a company that has a product like an S19 in it, like an audit, a regulator or a tax authority or a bureaucrat, the only way for them to know what's going on inside that machine is to essentially invade your privacy and force you to disclose what software you're running. So it would be the equivalent of if you've got a MacBook in front of you, the government coming in and saying, well, we want to know what software you're running, and we're going to apply different rules to how you're taxed or governed based on what you're running on your computer. That's certainly not going to fly in the U.S. It might fly in North Korea, but it's not going to fly in the U.S. or most Western nations.
So having multi-purpose S19s will be important to kind of bypass these regulations.
I think, yeah, to legitimately be able to have different applications that run on them. And yes, yes, that's the moral of the story.
Okay, perfect. Well, really quick, I just want to give a quick thank you to our partners, Black Sheep Ammo. Refill your ammo supplies at blacksheepammo.com. Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. Punch Plate, get a metal seed plate or get a metal plate for your seed phrase at punchplate.com. And Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms training at paladintowertactics.com. Bob, so we're getting on the top of the hour, so I want to start kind of wrapping things up. But I've heard you mention a couple times with Preston and on your X page, you believe that in the next in the years coming, there's going to be a really big demand for securing block space. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you believe financial institutions are going to be paying a lot of money to guarantee to have a certain block space. Can you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah. So each year, there are 53,000 blocks, give or take 500. And there's really nothing that's ever going to change that, right? I think we've already had the block size wars, the 10-minute block time is a key element of the protocol. I really don't see either of those changing. And we had the block size wars, which produced a 4 million weight unit block. And for those that don't know what that means, it basically means on average there's about 4,000 transactions that can go on every block. So that means 53,000 blocks a year, 4,000 transactions per block, that's about 200 million base layer transactions annually. And it's my opinion that there will be no material change to that number, at least in our lifetimes. But there are 8 billion people in the world. There are 330 million companies in the world. And so that means access to the base layer, even with a tiny change in adoption from where we are today, means that access to that block space will become a luxury. And by the way, that's kind of a radical thing. It wasn't your question, so I won't go into it too much, but it does. If you start thinking about that, it forces you to rethink some things because there's not enough room for everybody to be on Bitcoin. Like as an example, if I want to give 10,000 sats to everybody in the world, it would take about 40 years of 100% domination of the base layer for that to occur. So now if you also imagine a world, we'll think a few years in advance, where big parts of the global economy start running on Bitcoin, then access to the base layer becomes existential to financial institutions. So a financial institution that does not have access and control over some part of the base layer is like a bank without access to Fedwire in the Swiss system. In other words, it makes no sense. So this is a short version of my answer to this, but essentially I believe that we are going to see financial institutions move into the mining sector in a big way. I'm not saying I like this, by the way. I'm just saying I think that this is the inevitable endpoint. And the reason would be, let's say I'm a Bank of America. If I'm Bank of America, I want to guarantee that anybody that's a client of mine that wants to transact in Bitcoin can do so in a reasonable time frame at a reasonable cost. And the way Bitcoin works today, where each transaction kind of presents itself in real time to the marketplace, and there's a bidding process and all that, I think that we're at the end of that era. Because what I think will happen is a company like Bank of America, I think will find a way to get access to, let's say, 1% of global hash rate at least control of the Bok template creation for 1%. And that means that on average, they'll have 1 to 1.5 blocks per day that they make the decision about what transactions go in. And so that would give them 4,000 to 6,000 transactions a day. And they can go to their biggest clients, high net worth people, big corporate customers, et cetera. And they can say, hey, would you need access to the base layer? We will guarantee it for you as part of your service and part of banking with us. I also think, you didn't ask this question, I also think it's the reason that nation states will become miners. A lot of people think about nation state mining and nation states accumulating Bitcoin in their treasury. And I certainly think that will happen. But I think the bigger story is this one, that nation states will need to create a mechanism to control some percentage of block space in order to be sovereign. So if I was, in other words, if I was the president of Bolivia right now, I would start building Bitcoin mining infrastructure, or I would create incentives for miners to come to Bolivia and set up operations. But the caveat would be that I would create a Bolivia mining pool, or and I would force all those people mining within Bolivia to use my template, meaning that I could now guarantee that the country of Bolivia will have an opportunity to have international commerce, and that the companies and the citizens of the country would have a mechanism to do the same thing.
Do you think countries are starting to do this right now? And would that explain why the hash price is getting so high? They're trying to build up their, their miners?
I don't think that is why right now. I think there is a little bit of the hash, the global hash inflation has been from nation state adoption. I think part of it is, you know, Russia. And I think a lot of people look at it from the energy angle. I think you have people in the Middle East, you have people in like the Russians, the Iranians, who are using some of their excess energy to mine Bitcoin and get a hard currency. I would expect very soon that they're going to have the realization that I'm kind of projecting here today or professing here today, that the sovereignty of their country and their ability to transact internationally will not be dependent on how much Bitcoin they have, but based on how much block space they can control. So I think that realization will come. I think the sooner countries get that, the better. But I also think that, like I said, these big financial institutions will be involved. So this is another way of saying, by the way, that a lot of people look at the kind of potential merger or the expected merger of kind of the energy sector to the mining sector. And there's certainly a great symbiotic relationship between them. But I think in the long run, it's dwarfed by the importance of mining to the financial sector and the nation state. And because I don't believe Bitcoin is existential to anybody in the energy sector. If you're an energy producer, you could still do just fine without participating in Bitcoin. But I think if you're a financial institution or you're a country, then having Bitcoin mining operations is existential.
Okay, that's very interesting. So just really quick, as we're at the top of the hour, we need to start wrapping up. Do you think that this happens in this cycle, or do you think it's the next cycle?
Well, I think it will take a couple decades to fully embody, but I think it starts in this cycle. I think more progressive countries are starting. Will start in this cycle, yes. And the financial institutions, for sure. Like, I can tell you, I can't say who, I have already been in contact with, like, a huge financial institution who sees this.
Interesting. Does it happen to rhyme with watermelon?
No.
I'm just joking. No. So, well, Bob, I...
Not U.S. Also say not U. I'll tell you this, not U.S.-based, interestingly.
Okay.
Not a U.S.-based one, but a really big international financial services company.
Well, I find that very bullish. And I think that the price going on right now is kind of short-term outlook. I think we all need to get back to our Bitcoin roots and have a long-term view on this, and I think it'll be good. But Bob, I do have to start wrapping everything up. I got to take my dog to the vet. And so I want to thank you so much for coming on here, driving out and getting cell reception. I know we had some issues at the beginning, but I really appreciate you taking the time and making an effort to get on here today. Where should we point everybody to find you, to follow you?
Well, obviously, I'm on Twitter, Boomer_BTC. You can learn about Barefoot at Barefoot Mining. If you're a miner and you're looking to point some hash rate somewhere different, ocean.xyz. And I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate all you guys are doing with Operation Gabriel too. That's a wonderful initiative.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. And I definitely want to have you back on. I have a ton of questions I still like to ask you. We just kind of ran out of time today. But again, I want to thank everybody who tuned in. Everybody in the audience, Lisa, Punchplate, Tom Tabor, Gabe, Jordan, Yomar, Macro Minutes, I saw you guys up here. I really appreciate everything and everybody who had us on the background. It means a lot to us. Make sure you join us again tomorrow. Tomorrow, I can't believe it's Friday already. We're doing this again at 10 a.m. Make sure you tune into that. We'll do a recap of the week, update with Operation Gabriel, and any other major news that's going on. Get out there. Make sure you're spreading the Bitcoin mission. Again, it's just making connections with small communities. We don't have to change the entire country. We just need to change our immediate surroundings. So talk to your friends, talk to your community members about the power of Bitcoin and point them up at Operation Gabriel and what we're doing with that. Again, that's through efforts from all of us. Just because you're not boots on the ground doesn't mean you're not helping with that. So please just go out there and talk about it. If you haven't donated yet, I'm going to ask for more donations because, again, this isn't just done right now. We're going to continue with this effort for weeks and months. And at the very least, if you could just retweet the link at the top and get that message spread out there. Again, I want to thank everybody, and I will see you all tomorrow morning. Go out there and crush it. And thank you so much for Bob for coming on today.